A range of issues to explore. Well, I thought I might start with some of the skills that you either alluded to or, in fact, actually demonstrated up there. So, Bernard, you know, given the audience, I think many people here will be familiar with those, as Simon called them, facts that you put up there. Mm-hmm. But it's not just reading the facts, is it? This whole thing about interpreting, but even into the next step, you know, how do you turn that into a crystal ball? What do you see? What are the core skills for reading that and being able to make some reasonable type predictions for 2020?
If I take a negative view of the sort of thing that I do, if I wanted to parody what Bernard Salt does, I'd say, well, he's really a corporate astrologer, isn't he? He reads the tea leaves. All those facts, those numbers, if you like, come out from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Anyone is free to read them. It's how you actually take that information, put it into a map, or look at the tables on the ethnic compositions and so forth. It's the interpretation you impose upon that. And I like to do that from what I call altitude. Stand back from Australia, look at it over 100 years, look at it over 10 years, ask the big picture questions. Rather than getting bogged down into how things might have changed from this quarter to last quarter, stand back and look at the entire playing field. And I suppose that's really the sort of thing that Simon does, ask those really big picture questions. I have a training in history. I'm actually a trained history school teacher. So perhaps it's my academic background that makes me look at things from a time perspective. And when you look at it something like that, you tend to ask those big picture questions. What has the Australian nation done with the Australian continent? Are we seeing a fundamental shift in the ethnic influences on the Australian nation? How might our values, our palate, our preferences shift as a consequence? Are there generations that rise and fall? It's only when you take that big picture, almost historical perspective that you can see those questions. The numbers, they're actually boring. But it's the way you look at it. And I would encourage people to take a view from altitude. If there's one thing that I've noticed with industry, with business, is that business tends to be very focused on this quarter, next quarter. You're driven by budgets, of course. Occasionally, you should, I think, impose the discipline upon yourself to take that big picture perspective and look at something over a long period and see whether you're, in fact, on the right track.
So that altitude approach, can you learn that skill?
I think it's a unique combination of my background and interests, if you like. Having studied history at university, went on and did a master's degree in urban development, of course, and it gives you a different perspective. But I have an interest in history and even in sciences. If you read a lot of my columns, you'll see a reference to paleontology or to geology, for example. So I think reading broadly, having a broad intellectual interest, and then bringing that to bear in your day-to-day work, I would like to think that I certainly do that. I wrote a column about a month ago on what I called the pre-Cambrian explosion, which was a period of 500 million years ago where life shifted from basically, you know, stuff in the oceans to the proliferation of life forms. And I used that as an analogy to talk about changes in social culture in society over the last 20 years or so. I had a tremendous response to that. People respond to lateral big picture thinking. Especially business, they like that. They don't get enough of it, in my view. It's very colourful, it makes people think, and it's very engaging. And the only way I can suggest that you do it is to be very, very intellectually broad in your range of interests.
Can I comment on that?
Please.
I'd like to support that completely. I've started to talk to a number of boards around the country about what I call the tiger in the room. We're all used to the idea of an elephant in the room, which everybody can see but no one names. I think, again, and I draw a lot on history as well, if you look at the major strategic failures that occur throughout history, it's caused by the tiger in the room, which is that strategic risk which nobody sees, but just sits there and closes its jaws on the throat of an individual or an organisation or a society. And I got this notion of the tiger actually at Taronga Zoo here in Sydney, where they used to have the old display for the tigers with a Perspex screen, which if you look through it, you only could see in black and white, which is the way that I think virtually all animals see without the benefit of colour vision. And tigers basically disappear. I mean, I've been in India and seen them in the wild and I've got colour vision and that's hard enough. In black and white, they are remarkably difficult to spot. Well, the thought here is that what you find is that the reason why so many people don't see the tiger, I mean, there are some directors and some people who are a bit like two-year-olds who do this, you know, they put their hand over their face and they say, well, you can't see me, thinking that if they don't look for the risk, it won't see them. But, of course, the world refuses to be tamed just by our ignorance of it. But the more significant problem is that if you've been educated to see the world in green, and you can see the world in all of the different shades of green, but you can only see in green, then you're not going to see an orange tiger. And we have, particularly in this country, a relentlessly vocational approach to education, so that many people are trained to see the world just this way. Mm. They see the world as a lawyer sees the world, or as an accountant, or an actuary, or whatever it happens to be. And I think we miss out on a lot of opportunities, and we don't spot a lot of risks because we don't have that broader perspective. And I think it's essential that we find ways to do that, which is why it's interesting now that you start to see that there's a little bit of a movement. It's not a huge one, for people, instead of doing MBAs, might be doing things like a Master of Fine Arts or something which broadens their intellectual discipline.
So while we're on skills, Simon, you made a compelling case of being the importance of being clear on our values and being able
and
to...
Principles.
And principles. And be able to think ethically. Again, how do we get that sort of skill?
Well, by practising it. I mean, it's really quite straightforward. The notion of what a value is simply a word we give for anything that we say is good. Mm-hmm. So if we think that trust is good and that we would want to choose an option which gives trust, then that would be one of our values, or it could be any one of a number of things. There's not an infinite number, but there's a large number. And societies tend to differ in terms of their relative priority they accord to these. What principles do is that they regulate the means by which we secure those things which are good. So we might say success is good. We could be thinking, let's get a gold medal in the next Olympic if we're, say, a sports person. How do I get it? Do I take performance-enhancing drugs? Do I cheat my way to victory? No, some people would say that wouldn't be right. So you've got these two questions about what's good and what's right. Those then, in a professional context or an organisational context, need to be linked in some way to that defining purpose. And I chanced my arm, probably rashly, by thinking about the defining purpose of the actuarial profession. And I came up in my own mind, and people might correct me, but I thought this notion of insight into what is probable as a way that helps me then and others make informed decisions seemed to be what the purpose was. And if that's so, then you can start to cash out. Well, there'd be certain things that you'd want people to say are good and right. There'd be values and principles that must be attached to that notion. And it's then a matter of practising the process. It's like the process of responsible decision-making is something which must be engaged in, otherwise you lose it, which is why I'm so concerned when I see a headlong rush to increase regulation and surveillance as the principal or sometimes sole response to risk. What you would all know, because I'm sure you look below the surface of these things, is that beyond a certain point, regulation and surveillance create systemic risk. Because if you were, and it's not actually possible to do it for reasons we all understand, to create a system in which this would be complete because of the costs, but if you did create a world in which no one could choose to do what was wrong, then inadvertently you create a world in which no one can choose to do what is right. Yeah. And this is because you just comply, you just tick the box. And this is not, again, a piece of theory. Anybody who lived as we have, and I was sort of quite close to this, to the last gasp of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the first emergence of people from Eastern Europe, you will know that when those people came out, they talked about the need once again to relearn how to make responsible decisions because they hadn't been required to. So you think about a risk framework in this society, in which we progressively remove the requirement from people to make responsible decisions. We don't see it. It's one of these tigers, but you can see the systemic risk beginning to increase. So I'm starting to find a lot of time talking to boards of companies in this Australia and a bit overseas, explaining this to them, because at the moment they're on the compliance merry-go-round, and it's every spin it gets slightly more dangerous.
So it's not a spectator sport. It's about practice implementation.
It's about practice. It's a bit like, you know, you think, you know, if you want to be able to avoid a tree when you're skidding towards it on an icy road, you don't say, oh, let's learn it now when I'm there. You want to go on a skid pad, so you practice.
But Simon, we seem to be moving then to a world of increasing compliance. Every business, I speak right across Australia,
it's crazy.
Every industry, and every topic I follow is, you know, compliance issues. We seem to be moving at a rate of knots around being forced to comply the whole range of requirements, if you like, in every industry. Is this actually doing more harm
Absolutely.
Than good in the long run?
It is. I can take you through the arguments. It gives you an illusion of certainty. And what it does is it builds systemic risk. I'm not saying you don't have compliance. Look, you know, if I'll be on a plane in the next 2 days, I don't want the pilot to get in the plane and say, oh, let's forget the checklist and go for a bit of a fly. But equally, I don't want to have happen what sometimes does happen, where people follow the checklist into the ground.
Yeah.
That will happen, and we just don't see it because there's lots of... It's even now people in terms of natural disaster management are realising now that the building of these side constraints, which are levies and other things, which are the social equivalent of rules, regulations and surveillance systems, rather than protecting you, they actually risk causing greater disaster. And there's lessons that have come out of the United States in terms of flood mitigation and things like that. You're better off dealing with cultural change, where you get communities better able to understand and adapt to their environment, rather than constantly build these dikes, which when they finally fail, cause major systemic problems.
The other skill that I wanted to pick up, which you mentioned, Simon, you know, differentiated leadership from management.
Yes.
And again, made a case for the importance of leadership. So what do you see as the core to leadership skills for your definition of leadership?
Well, I think I tried to outline three elements. Mm-hmm. One is a general approach to leadership, which is that notion of constructive subversion. Managers can afford to sit on the cork, and the cork takes them wherever the flow of the stream might be. Leaders don't just go with the flow. They constantly assess, challenge and develop organisations, as I say, to make them more like the thing they say they want to be. That in part means having a forensic examination of the systems, policies and structures within which people operate. I mean, it's extraordinary if you actually look, as we do through some of our consulting work, into organisations. You'll see that they say they want to be here, but all their systems, policies and structures are sending signals to people that they want them to go there. What they measure, what they reward, are completely out of alignment with their strategic directions. But people don't think that that matters. Well, leaders do. Secondly, there requires, therefore, moral courage, because it's almost inconceivable in most organisations that people will welcome a leader actually practising their craft, because it's destabilising. It says, well, you know, it's not good enough that we just do things. People say, shut up, you know, we know what we're doing, just let me get on with it. And so you require great moral courage to lead. And you also need strategic vision, which is this capacity to operate in three different levels at once. You have to be able to take a kind of a helicopter view that Bernard was talking about, where you can see patterns and connections. You need to be in the submarine or whatever it is to get the undercurrents, and you have to be present in the moment. And as you do this, there's all sorts of issues around empathy and capacity that leadership have. Now, those skills are human capacities which are only learned in their practice. They're kind of embodied things. You don't learn them sitting in a classroom. Yeah. Going through management textbooks or other things. There's a different mode by which human beings are exposed to the challenges of leadership. And our society at present, partly because of the amount of money we spend on compliance, refuses to invest in leadership. We just don't do it.
Mm. You anticipated the question about how we learn that, so thank you for that. There was influences that people have asked for you to speculate on. And so this question, I'll probably throw it to both. There's a number of them that have come up. The first is with the increase in education. coupled with, for that generation, an increased use of social media. The extent to which that is influencing that cynicism and you know, where you see that might take it influences in the future, Bernard.
There's no doubt that social media is a very real, growing and powerful part of modern society. I write a column in The Australian twice weekly, and I've had a column since 2002, and at the end of it, I have my email address, and for 8-9 years, you get emails every Thursday, and you might get 10 or even 20 if it was a really contentious column. For the last 2 years, I have I've been putting a Twitter link as well, and what I have found is that I might get 5 or 6 emails today, but there is this entire discussion taking place in Twitter. That if I was not predisposed, I hadn't even heard of it. It was like bok choy. had not even heard of Twitter until about 18 months ago, and thought, oh, you know, I'll sort of keep this Gen Y advisor happy and I'll start it off. And then, you know, about 6 months later, I discovered how to actually check my name. See, not just what I was putting up there.
Mentions.
All this stuff is happening. This complete level of discussion is taking place, which I had not seen, and not all of it was fantastic. There was a couple of there was one column I wrote about 18 months ago where I was on food, you know, it's a very wide ranging brief, and I talked about navel oranges. Now, I have a problem in the fruit and vegetable department, as you can tell. And I spelled it N-A-V-A-L. I mean, who knows how to spell navel oranges? I read the spell check over it. Anyway, these people on Twitter absolutely ripped me apart. You know, Bernard Salt doesn't know how to, you know, and there was a letter to the editor the
we
next day.
We have navel
saying,
lemons, do we?
No, no. Bernard Salt's obviously all at sea with his navel oranges or whatever. I cannot go past navel oranges now by noting the E. But the point is that the old way of communicating is gone. If you are a columnist, if you're in the business of shaping or reflecting public opinion, and I suppose this would apply in business as well, then you must be in that space. You must be... you must have a footprint in that space. And it gathers momentum. It's the first thing I look to now. Every Thursday, I'd just check my email to see what emails are coming in. Now I'll check Twitter just to see how the column is running. And you get a fair feel by about 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, whereas the emails, you might get, you know, 4 or 5 by about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you can tell whether you've hit the mark, you've spelt something incorrectly, you've offended someone or whatever it is, but you get that almost immediate response. So very, very important.
Yeah. Your comment on the impact of social media? And
well, it's clearly significant. There are countervailing ways of thinking about it. There is that phenomenon that you'd be aware of, the wisdom of the crowd, mm-hmm. which if you haven't read this book of that title by James Sierwisky, from The Economist, I think, it's well worth having a look at, just about particularly, you know, the statistical effects if you get large enough numbers of people contributing to some kind of process of deliberation. So there's something good in that sense that you can imagine about being tapping into it. But I have probably a slightly more concern than regard that so much which gets published is ill-founded, and that I think two things that we're at risk of in that process of publishing, if you like, that social media effectively is. One is that there isn't a sufficient process to distinguish between what is mere opinion or falsehood and that which can be relied upon as the basis for making some kind of decision. And the other is that the public space becomes narrowed into a series of contiguous private spaces. So if you pick up a newspaper at the moment, one of the good things about it is that you bump into stories that you never intended to read. A sub-editor may have put in a reasonable headline, there may be something about it. And you make connections about things that are happening in the world, which you wouldn't otherwise do if you were confined simply to a narrative which was predefined mm-hmm. by your existing interests. So if all you're going to read is about sport or about this or that, the chance of making those interesting connections that explain the world can be lost. Now, I think there are ways of overcoming that. You can be a voracious, you know, sort of screener of these comments, and it is possible to think even of a business model where people could start taking the content that's being provided by way of blogs, Twitter, and everything else, and start to sort of assign it a value in terms of its reliability. But you sort of need that if you're going to navigate your way. Otherwise, you just have a blizzard of data, some of which might actually be information, and some of which might actually constitute knowledge on which you can rely. And it's how you get that which you ultimately require to make informed decisions, which I think is part of the challenge.
Okay. The other, another influence, Simon, given the decline of trust, to what extent has the industry of PR and spin doctoring been responsible, in your opinion, for some of that decline of trust in institutions and organisations?
Well, I think it's played its role, but my estimation would be that it would have been relatively benign if it hadn't been for the fact that so many institutions themselves have forgotten the central purpose for which they exist. I think we're in this midst of what I call a long age of forgetting, in which institutions, sometimes millennia old, which began with some very deep, important insight about some basic human need. Take a market. You know, you can imagine somebody meeting at a ford in a river. Somebody's got wool, someone's got wheat, one's cold, the other's hungry, they exchange. There's something elemental about that. There are all sorts of other things of this kind which get forgotten because people become distracted by these dogmas, doctrines, architecture, a whole lot of other things. So I think that's where we are at the moment, and I think that is far more the seat of the problem, if you like, rather than the spin that's done to try and cover it up. In a sense, the spin meisters and all the rest are a product of that forgetting and the inability to navigate where these institutions might go.
Can I just add there, I've done some research on this. At the last census, 5 years ago, of course, there were about 6,500 journalists on print, radio, television on the Australian continent. There were 13,500 public relations consultants. There is two PR spin doctors for every person actually delivering the news. I'll be looking for the results of the new census to see whether, in fact, that's getting worse or, in fact, better.
Also interesting.
It's probably getting worse.
You want to look at the ratio of journalists to AFL players, too.
Oh, right.
That's
okay.
An extraordinary figure.
The other area of interest, we've got to speculate, Bernard, the impact, two things, the impact on religious beliefs of some of the changes you reflect in terms of ethnic background. And then, in turn, the impact of religious beliefs on business. And I think one of the examples is the concept of commercial surrogacy, for example. And, of course, you'll get a turn, Simon.
Yes, it's interesting. I've actually predicted a return to traditional religion over the next, 10, 15 years or so, as baby boomers move, get into their older age, the older age group. If you look at the propensity to believe in God, it actually increases as you get older. There is none so devout on the Australian continent than the 90-year-old population. The closer you get to God, the closer you get to God, basically. I mean, if you think you're going to bump into him or her next day, well, then you hedge your bets. But I certainly do see almost a polarisation at the moment. There are certainly Christian religions that are growing profoundly. So the Catholic religion, particularly with the ethnic influences of the Mediterraneans or Christian religions over the last 20, 30 years or so, as well as some Middle Eastern religions as well. So you've got this sort of... I'd actually put that in sort of not traditional but fervent belief, fervent believers, but the fastest growing religious belief on the Australian continent, if you look at the censuses, is actually no belief at all, atheism. Why would you believe in a hereafter when the here and now is so damn good? And if you go back to the Great Depression, the 1930s, the people that are really devout actually came from that time. Now, is it because they're just getting old, or is it because in times of great calamity, World War I the Great Depression, World War II, the hereafter must be far better than the here and now. So in times of plenty, times of prosperity, during a time, we might shift away from belief, the idea of accountability as a movement. That has certainly been a major shift in Australian society over the last 20 or 30 years, the rise of atheism. Now, that has to some degree been offset by the rise of Catholicism, the rise of other particular fervent beliefs, if you like, but the overwhelming shift has been towards nothingism. Maybe we've shifted towards hedonism, meism, nowism, consumerism. I believe in the here and now. I don't care about the hereafter.
So?
Well, I think that there'll be a continuing engagement with spirituality, but it won't necessarily be expressed in an adherence to particular religions unless those religions can do one of two things. The preferred response would be if those religions find a way to be authentic in the expression of their founding ideals. But there is another possibility, and it's one I don't like the thought of, and that is that in the face of complexity, human beings with their... They have one of two possible responses. The first is the hedonistic response, which Bernard has described. Let's all get drunk and hope that somebody else has sorted it out when we sober up. But the even more seductive call for those who struggle with this is from those who offer fundamentalism, whether it be in religion, politics, or anything. People faced with genuine complexity, and there's plenty of that in life, will often be lured by the siren call of those who say, actually, it's not that difficult. We know what to do. We'll tell you. You just do that and you'll be fine. And many people surrender into the arms of those saying, oh, phew, so I don't have to think about this. Part of our work is to try and convince people not to do either of those two things, but instead to be prepared to stick with the difficulty of being responsible for your own decisions. And to the extent that religions are authentic, I think they support that engagement. When they collapse either into their own dogmatics or abandon their beliefs, then I think they repel people.
Can I borrow 5 minutes of your morning tea to explore one other topic that seems dear to your hearts, and that's the issue of business cases and Simon's plea that not everything is about economic analysis. There's two questions arising. One, what has driven that reliance, that imperative about the business case, the economic analysis, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's partly a loss of confidence in the language because it's contestable. I mean, I cannot imagine that William Wilberforce just 200 years ago would have stood up, because I know he didn't, in the House of Commons saying, you know, I've come to address the abolition of slavery. Here's the report from Access Economics that says why it cost him. Yeah. He was much more confident in saying, actually, this is just wrong. But I actually think, I mean, please don't take from my comments that I'm pessimistic about this. You are already seeing a move now in the wake of the global financial crisis to bring into consideration a much broader range of considerations. I mean, the environmental, social and governance issues are being integrated into the way in which companies report and their own performance. So I was a thing yesterday with talking about the International Integrated Reporting Council and fundamental changes to accounting practices. I think employees within businesses, others, are all looking for these other things. It's a question as to whether or not we will allow different types of language, not to edge economics out, but to say, you know, they have a place too in terms of the spectrum of matters that we consider when we look at this. And I just think that we need to start talking about these things and to live with the contestability and be able respectfully to engage in discussion, even in disagreement, to see these different ways of looking at a problem. And to do, if we do so, I think we'll find that it enriches the nature of our discourse. But that's the opportunity. I just think at the moment we really struggle to take it.
Add, I think that management and boards are incredibly risk-averse these days. They are too nervous to make a decision without actually calling for a consultant's report or a business case.
Or even the lawyer's opinion.
Even for the most simple things that you could imagine. Mm.
Right, bring that to a close. Before I propose formal thanks, just a couple of reminders. So we're off for morning tea, and then we have the two concurrent sessions. For lunch today, we have a very special guest in John Trowbridge. Yesterday, I was very proud of you. You were all very quick and efficient in getting your buffet lunch and being seated for our guest speaker. So if you could follow that practice again today, that would be much appreciated. Don't forget the feedback forms, and we'll look forward to this afternoon's plenary session, which we've actually had a lead-in with some references from Simon talking about the role of the profession in terms of social policy. So that will be an excellent way for Barry to take up that challenge when we deal with plenary for this afternoon. So please join me in thanking very much behind our excellent guest speakers. Firstly, Simon Longstaff, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And Bernard Salt, very well done.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.